This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, high school valedictorians didn't get their moment to shine at a typical graduation ceremony, but they still have some things to say.
I want people to know that what we do now does impact what happens in the future. And I don't think my generation realizes that yet.
We'll also meet a special valedictorian who says she was in disbelief when she learned about the honor. Colleges and universities had a topsy-turvy semester, having to switch to online instruction. Now the focus is on getting students back on campus this fall. We'll hear about a task force working to make that happen. And a new syndrome linked to the coronavirus is impacting children. What's known about it? We'll find out. Statewide is brought to you by AARP Illinois, providing information that can help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way this hour, we'll hear from some high school valedictorians who didn't get the chance to stand in front of their classmates and deliver their speeches, but they have plenty to say. We'll take a listen. A new syndrome apparently linked to the coronavirus is impacting kids. We'll speak with a doctor about that. And what's the health situation like inside prisons? That and more coming up on Statewide. Colleges and universities across Illinois have to deal with the possibility of COVID-19 if they reopen in the fall, or even if they don't. Bill Wheelhouse talked with Ginger Ostro, she's the executive director of the Illinois Board of Higher Education, about preparing for the fall semester.
Well, we know there's a lot of uncertainty around what's going to happen in the fall, but one thing we know for certain is that Illinois colleges and universities remain one of the best, most affordable options for many of our students. And if I could say anything to the students of Illinois, it would be, stick with your plans to go to college, that we want people to continue on their path to getting their degrees. We know the institutions, and we want our colleges and universities to be open this fall, and we know they will be open, whether it's with remote learning, whether it's in person or some combination, but it will be safely. And that's what's the most important thing here, that students stay on track and that we know that our institutions will be safe for them to get their education.
As you look ahead, you're now, from an administrative and bureaucratic standpoint, have put together kind of a task force that's going to look into these issues. Can you tell me a little bit about that and what their charge is?
The governor announced the Restore Illinois plan, the multi-phase, bi-phase plan to reopen Illinois. And we have convened a task force of higher education leaders, presidents of our public universities, our community colleges, and our private universities to come together and say, how do we operationalize the phased-in plan that's outlined in Restore Illinois? What does that look like, and how do we bring students back to campus safely? How do we provide distance instruction if necessary? But what are the key questions that we need to answer? And how do we provide guidance to our institutions in making those decisions?
And how will those questions be answered?
Well, we have enormous number of experts through our university presidents, many of whom are working and have been deeply thinking with task forces on their campuses about how to reopen safely on whatever phase we are in Restore Illinois come fall. We have experts from the University of Illinois who have been providing guidance throughout the COVID-19 crisis, from research expertise to data analysis and modeling. They will be advising this committee. And we also have public health guidance from the SIU School of Medicine as well. So we have a broad range of expertise in the room to help create this outline.
You have probably been talking, thinking about this. This has been on your mind and college presidents' minds for a while. As you approach that, what do you think will be the biggest challenge into getting campuses open to the public come fall?
Well, it's all driven by the data and the science and the metrics that are outlined in the Restore Illinois plan. There's very clear guidance around what metrics need to be met in order to meet each phase. And when we get from one phase to the next, to decide how to bring students back safely. So the kinds of questions that the committee will have to struggle with are, how do you do hands-on courses, labs, or other hands-on instruction with social distancing? What does that look like? How do we treat courses that were typically large lecture courses? What does that model look like? How do we address that? Or if you can't have large groups or large gatherings of students and you want to maintain social distancing, how often do we clean and how do we clean classrooms after each meeting if there is on in-person courses? How do we organize residence halls to ensure that there's safety and cleaning and appropriate social distancing is needed? So those are the kinds of questions that the committee will wrestle with.
For example, let's take a 250, 300 seat lecture hall. How many students do you think you would be able to put in that if the social distancing requirements were still in place at that time?
Well, I think it'll be specific to each institution, how they structure their courses and what way they provide the education for courses that may be large courses. Maybe it's broken down into multiple sections. Maybe parts of it are offered online and only some are in person. So I think there's a whole variety of things that could be considered, but the main things are to follow the parameters that are in the Restore Illinois guidance, public health guidelines for social distancing and sanitation and other safe practices, and to make the best decisions, but that will be under these guidelines, but each campus will have to decide how it works best for their programs.
Do you foresee that we will see a use of large gymnasiums and auditoriums and things of that nature converted for at least some academic use?
I think there's a lot of different options and things to consider. And again, I think it's specific to each campus, what facilities they have, how they will use them. And really the goal of this committee is to help provide that decision-making criteria. What are the things that some institutional leaders should be considering when they have to make decisions about how to operate and provide instruction or operate other facilities on their campuses?
Budgetarily, this has been a rough time for a lot of colleges, most colleges. For instance, we see McMurray College closing down. There have to be some presidents fearful that their schools, especially smaller ones, might be in danger. As you look at this from 50,000 feet from your position, do you see a lot of schools more in danger if they don't get to have students on campus in the fall?
Well, we certainly know these are challenging times across the state, across the country, across the world. We know the budget pressures are enormous and that these are part of the challenges that our institution leaders are facing and working through right now, evaluating different scenarios, trying to make plans based on what they think might happen, really contingency planning. And we know we have incredible value in our higher education system in the state, and we need to maintain that. But we also know it's tough times, and we're grateful that the institutions are doing everything that they can to figure out how to manage through this really unprecedented crisis.
How do you think that second half of the semester went with online learning, with a mix of people that had not participated in online learning and others who were purely experts at it?
I think it's something that we obviously want to look at and evaluate, but every single day people learned and did better. And it was amazing what the higher education system was able to do to pivot from completely in-class learning to online learning in less than, you know, just a couple of weeks. So a testament to the work of the faculty, to the students, to the leaders, the IT support to be able to make that pivot. I think what it means is, as we go forward, that if there is continued online learning, we're going to continue to benefit from the experience and continue to grow.
And when does do you hope that your committee has its information together and a report ready?
Well, we know folks are anxious to have the information to make decisions, to understand what's going to happen in the fall. So the committee is going to work quickly and pull together the best guidance and produce a report and the information and the guidance for the state as quickly as possible, recognizing that there's a lot of uncertainty out there.
Ginger, is there anything you'd like to add, clarify, or mention that I didn't ask you about?
What I'd say is to go back to where we began, which is to encourage students to stick with their plans for higher education, to stay on track, to continue to earn credits towards their degree. Know that even though times are uncertain, the Board of Higher Education, the Governor's Office, the leaders of our institutions are working hard to make sure that when campuses open on the fall, we have plans that are there to make sure that campuses open safely, whether that's through distance learning, on campus, or some combination.
That's Ginger Ostro, Executive Director of the Illinois Board of Higher Education, and she spoke with Bill Wheelhouse. Life is full of peaks and valleys. Commentator Allison Vauder says we can gain perspective by learning from those who've come and gone before us.
This was supposed to be an eventful week in our families, particularly those of us with Macomb High School students. Prom and Mother's Day last weekend, and graduation this coming weekend. Every special event in our lives is being celebrated as best we can against the backdrop of a period unique in the history of all but those of us who are over 102, a global pandemic. This week has me thinking about adaptation and resilience. I have two great uncles buried in the Bushnell Cemetery who died during the 1918 epidemic, but my grandparents never talked much about this time in their lives. When I knew them 50 and more years later, they were pretty stoic people, looking back on a long life with all of its ups and downs. The story I best remember my grandmother telling was about the February day in 1927 when the bottom went out of the dirt roads in McDonough County. She was driving a car and following my grandfather's wagon full of hogs on the way to market. It took hours to dig the car out. The horse and wagon had to come back and pitch in after the hogs were dropped off. At the end of the story, almost as an afterthought, my grandmother mentioned that my aunt, her first child, was born the next day. Nanny was from Pittsfield. She was an only child, descended from lawyers and town people. She would eventually inherit such useful things as her uncle's top hat that he wore to the opera, and a letter written by Abraham Lincoln to a shoestring relative who was a one-term senator from California, best known for a passionate speech about how wrong it would be to abolish the Senate tavern. Notwithstanding this outlier, my grandmother was the distillation of generations of dignified, rational, and intelligent people. She was in her late 20s and an old maid in the making when she came to Bushnell as a schoolteacher and later principal of the West Side School. Grandfather was 2 years older, a farmer's child, and one of many siblings. When Poppy was in the spotlight, he defaulted to playing the fool, singing, joking, showing how he could jump the dining room table with a short running start. He dreamed of being a professional baseball player or a businessman and went to Gem City Business College in Quincy until he was called back to take over the farm after his father died. Between the brothers who died of the flu and the brothers who left to homestead in Canada, he was the only one who could. He proposed to my grandmother by saying, "Well, we aren't getting any younger. I guess we should get married." She went home at Christmas and watched the mail anxiously for the ring my grandfather said he had ordered from the Sears catalog. It probably was not the way they envisioned this part of life going. Thus yoked together in an oddball partnership born of practicality, my grandparents did well in farming and went on to have two children, who between them produced 7 living grandchildren. This generation produced 13 great-grandchildren. My daughter, the youngest of that generation, was born 18 years after the last of my grandparents died. She graduates from high school this week. Overall, high school wasn't a good experience for my daughter. As much as she wanted to fit in, her authentic and unconventional traits refused to remain dormant, to her early frustration and later, defiant pride. We tried making a few adjustments, including changing schools, but in the end, we both had to agree that high school was not going to be the happiest period of her life. We arranged for her to finish her academics in February, knowing that this would result in a very different senior year for her than for her classmates. We could not have predicted that her classmates would forego these time-honored rituals as well, not from choice, but from necessity. As the young people we know graduate from high school this week during these strange times, remember and remind them that the ups and downs of high school do not define them. 14 to 18 is a very short period of time in a full human life. And as our children head off to leading the longest part of their lives as adults, they will tell the story of their last year of high school, how the bottom of the road of life unexpectedly went out, and what they woke up and did the next day and every day after that to lead their wonderful, amazing, and sometimes complicated lives. Someone who needs to hear about strength, who needs to internalize resilience, will be listening. Thank you, Nanny, and congratulations to the class of 2020. And on a more personal note, happy graduation, kid. You've continued growing into the person neither one of us envisioned, but the person you were exactly meant to be.
Allison Vauder is an attorney and a mediator in Macomb. There's still more ahead on Statewide. Stay with us. Support comes from AARP Illinois, providing information that can help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, how universities have been helping with COVID-19 testing capacity. Next, 360 people, including inmates and staff, have been diagnosed with COVID-19 in Illinois prisons, and at least 12 inmates have died. Some Illinois prisoners and their loved ones say that inmates need more cleaning and hygiene supplies. One group is donating hand sanitizer and soap. But as Lee Gaines reports for Illinois Newsroom, it's unclear whether incarcerated people are getting those supplies.
Thank you for using Securus. You may start the conversation now.
Hey, how you doing, Ms. Gaines?
This is Joseph Horton. He's incarcerated at Menard Correctional Center in Southern Illinois. I asked him earlier this month if he had received any hand sanitizer.
None of that. We get none of that. That's out of the question. We will never get that.
Horton says prison staff recently started giving inmates masks. And he says they routinely pass around water mixed with bleach so inmates can clean their cells. But he wishes he had more cleaning supplies.
I'm in a cell with another individual that's not clean. I'm the only one in here cleaning the cell. There's bugs. It's overwhelming. So overwhelming, it's just... I don't know. I'm stressed.
A group of academics and grad students are trying to help. Illinois prisons closed their doors to visitors in March to prevent the spread of COVID-19 inside correctional facilities. That also meant educators. So the group called the Illinois Coalition for Higher Education in Prison, or ILCHEP, asked the state's Department of Corrections what they could do to help.
And the response to that was we would really appreciate sanitizer and masks.
That's Rebecca Ginsburg. She's part of ILCHEP.
That was when it became clear that our roles were going to change from being that of educators to being among the parties that are working hard to do our best to ensure that our students and others who are locked up stay healthy and stay alive.
So Ginsberg says the group started assigning members different tasks. Ellen Ritter normally works with incarcerated students at the Danville Correctional Center. Now she's spearheading the effort to get hand sanitizer into Illinois prisons. Last month, she drove a big vehicle up to Chicago to pick up a batch of sanitizer the group purchased from a distillery. It was a chilly spring day, and Ritter was nervous.
This is like when COVID was just getting started and we're at a stay-at-home order and I'm driving up to a hot spot, kind of risking my own health and safety.
The group also had to buy 14,000 bottles to put the sanitizer in, plus labels for each bottle. And on top of that, they donated more than 50,000 bars of soap to the prison system. The total cost of all of that came to about $50,000. The money came from a grant from a private foundation and individual donations. A spokesperson for the Illinois Department of Corrections says they appreciate the donation. They say prison staff dispense hand sanitizer into inmates' hands throughout the day, and every prisoner gets a 3-ounce bar of soap each week. They say the donations were sent to 27 facilities across the state, but it's not clear how those supplies are actually being used inside state prisons. Cecilia Stewart has a son at the Stateville prison, which has been hardest hit by COVID-19.
He buys his own soap. They don't sanitize anything. If he wants to clean anything, he has to do it with his own supplies.
She says her son now gets a mask once a week, and someone comes around occasionally to spray his hands with hand sanitizer between his cell bars. Ginsberg, with ILCHEP, says the group is happy to do what they can to help. However, she says the group isn't sure how much longer they can afford to donate supplies. But no matter what, Ginsberg says they'll continue to advocate for better conditions for their incarcerated students. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
As states move toward reopening their economies, they're placing a lot of importance on COVID-19 testing. But many say their efforts to ramp up tests are still being hampered by a shortage of supplies, so some have looked to state universities to help. And Christine Herman with Side Effects Public Media brings us this report.
When University of Illinois virologist Chris Brook first heard about shortages of COVID-19 tests, he was puzzled because it involves simple steps his lab does all the time. So what could be so hard? But once he struck up a conversation with local health experts, the problem became clear.
There's this idea that you just have these testing kits and it's this thing that's in a box and you have everything you need to test someone. And that's not really the reality.
The reality is you need nasal swabs and the little tubes of liquid they get stored in. Then there's another liquid used to extract the genetic material from the sample and all the high-tech equipment to do the analysis and more.
To test someone for this coronavirus, you actually need a series of different components that are all subject to different degrees of shortage.
That's because every public health and clinical lab in the world has been trying to get their hands on all these same materials. So Brooke and academic researchers around the U.S. have been trying to help plug some of the gaps. Some University of Illinois labs loaned expensive equipment to the local hospital lab. Others designed nasal swabs, and Brooke decided to work on viral transport media, or VTM. It preserves the virus's genetic material between the time it's swabbed from a person's nose and throat and analyzed in a lab. A few dozen people have joined in the effort, including research tech Justin Lang. He sent me a video of what the process involves.
I have a pipette tip.
It's pretty straightforward. You mix a bunch of things together in water, nutrients, preservatives, and then do lots and lots of pipetting, putting small amounts of the sterile liquid into small plastic tubes.
The monotony is challenging, but once you have an efficient system in place, it, you know, becomes much less boring and much more fulfilling.
But it's also very labor-intensive, and there's no cost-effective way to automate it because it has to be done in a sterile environment. So Lang and his socially distant lab mate listen to podcasts and talk about news and sports as they pipette liquid into thousands of tubes every week that get sent to the state's public health lab. This pandemic has led to partnerships like this between state public health labs and universities across the country, including Purdue University and the University of Wisconsin.
It's still fairly unique, but I feel like it's on the rise.
Alana Sterkel is assistant director of a state lab in Wisconsin. It's rare in that it's part of UW-Madison's School of Public Health, and that connection came in handy in addressing COVID-19.
We learn from each other. We support each other. We're able to share resources in times of need.
And these days, lots of labs are in need. Brooke says there's no coordinated federal response to boost manufacturing of testing supplies and ensure states can get what they need. So individual labs have been left to compete with one another. For example, he once purchased a couple months' worth of supplies and later learned that it forced the vendor to turn away hospital labs seeking the same items.
So that's an awful feeling. I'm glad that we are able to do this and help the state, but I think it's terrible that us being able to do that means that some other place is not able to do it as effectively.
Looking forward, that competition for supplies is unlikely to slow, since testing will be vital to monitor outbreaks, especially as states move toward reopening their economies. I'm Christine Herman, Side Effects Public Media.
Health experts say coronavirus antibody testing is key to reopening the economy, since that test is intended to show if you've already contracted the virus and developed immunity. But so far, antibody tests have been limited and hard to find. Eric Stock took a look at a few locations where the tests are being done and what some of the early results show.
Leroy Dr. Tom Plora has been testing for antibodies for weeks. Today, he's opening a new temporary clinic at the Sports Enhancement Center in Bloomington, where he will offer coronavirus antibody and diagnostic testing.
The governor here in Illinois, I want to help him in any way I can to reopen or give him the level of comfort. And what I keep hearing is test, test, test. Well, but there's a lot of places that aren't doing that.
It seems very few are offering the antibody test. Peoria-based OSF Healthcare isn't testing for antibodies. Advocate Bromen Medical Center in Normal started antibody testing earlier this month. You need an order from an Advocate doctor to get one. A spokesperson says Advocate is looking to identify people who may be eligible to participate in convalescent plasma donation. Doctors have been studying plasma from the already infected as a possible COVID-19 treatment. Carle Health System has a hospital in Urbana and medical facility serving 41 counties in eastern Illinois and Indiana, and is in the process of acquiring Advocate Bromen and Advocate Eureka Hospitals. It started antibody testing a few weeks ago. Michaela Banks, Carle's Vice President of Quality, Women's and Children's Services, says it's been limited.
Mostly those who are, you know, frontline or first responders, including, you know, EMTs, other, you know, police force entities, to make sure that they're prioritized.
Banks says you can also request a test if you think you may have had the coronavirus before diagnostic testing was easily available, or if you are one of Carle's clinical workers at greatest risk of exposure. She says the medical provider was looking to see how widespread immunity may be. Banks says questions about immunity are what's keeping antibody testing from becoming more widespread. Will those antibodies protect you for life, for 5 or 10 years, or maybe only 1 year like the flu?
The hesitation in making it more widely available is still that, you know, we have very limited evidence around what, you know, positive antibodies mean clinically about someone's level of protection against either infection or reinfection going forward.
Another reason antibody testing has been sparse are reliability concerns. Reopening the economy based on a bunch of false positives could lead to more outbreaks. Dr. Tom Plora says his tests through LabCorp and Quest Diagnostics are highly reliable, unlike some of the testing done at the start of the pandemic.
I think these antibody tests early on got some bad press by China flooding the market or attempting to flood the market with some unreliable tests.
Kayla Banks at Carle Health System says she knew testing validity could be an issue since the FDA used an emergency authorization to rush these testing kits to the masses.
There are always concerns, I think, with reliability and validity, you know, in the test, as, you know, anything we do quickly is never quite as perfect as we would like. But with, you know, recognition that it's the best available at this time, we felt like it was still a value to implement here.
Carle Health System uses Abbott's antibody test, and Banks says Carle's own lab work has verified the test's accuracy. So what has the testing shown so far? Carle Health System has tested about 150 clinical workers, and 10% show antibodies. Banks says they're just filing away that info for now until they get a better sense for what it means.
It's really, you know, just sort of informational for our staff at this point, hoping that as soon as that information becomes available around, you know, what level of protection, if any, is provided by the presence of antibodies, you know, our staff can help with that understanding.
Dr. Tom Plura says less than 3% of the nearly 2,000 antibody tests he's given at his offices in Leroy, Champaign, and Marion show exposure to the coronavirus.
It makes sense that the penetration of this disease hasn't been as broad, you know, spectrum as what they've had in some places.
Plura says even if no one knows how long that immunity may last, knowing their immediate risk of exposure offers at least some peace of mind.
There is a tremendous desire for people to want to know. They want to know whether they had it or not.
Plura refers to it as the badge of immunity. I'm Eric Stock.
At least 10 children in Illinois have been diagnosed with a new syndrome linked to the coronavirus. Dr. Doug Carlson is chair of the pediatrics department at SIU School of Medicine in Springfield. Mary Hansen talked with him about a new statewide task force looking into multi-system inflammatory syndrome.
Can you tell me a little bit about what public health officials are seeing now when it comes to COVID-19 showing up in children?
We need to be clear about this. There's a difference between the acute infection in children, which has almost been exclusively very mild, and a rare delayed sort of development in a very small subset of those kids who develop what we're calling the multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children. The CDC is defining that as in people less than 21 that have a fever of at least 38 for at least 24 hours and more often longer, that develop symptoms of generalized inflammation, including their lungs, kidneys, heart, severe rashes, neurological symptoms.
So it sounds like this is almost separate from disease showing up in children, the cough and that sort of thing. This is something that's happening later on.
Yeah, that's an important point. What we've started to recognize over the last couple of weeks, initially in Europe and Italy and Great Britain, and then just a couple weeks ago in New York, there was a rare but identifiable syndrome where kids were showing back up that ended up being COVID positive or having antibodies to COVID that had a generalized body inflammation that sometimes could be very severe.
You've been appointed to a task force through the Illinois Department of Public Health to look at this phenomenon. What is the charge of that task force, and what have you been seeing or talking about so far?
What we're looking at first is really just getting out awareness to healthcare professionals and to the general public about what this is and what to look for. The CDC provided a case definition, and we're beginning then, based on that, to be looking at reporting. We do not have good reporting mechanisms for this, as it's a new syndrome. It looks like between all the experts who would know what's going on in those hospitals identified around 10 cases in Illinois. That may be a slight undercount, but it's not a lot more than that. All of those cases were in the Chicago area, which makes sense because internationally and nationally, this seems to be a syndrome that's following up in the areas where COVID virus was most prevalent.
So in terms of central Illinois, would you expect to see this potentially showing up here in the next several weeks?
Well, we've had pretty good evidence that there's not a lot of COVID virus in central Illinois. There's clearly some. We still need to take precautions, but there's not been a lot in kids. So we'll see.
In the initial weeks of the pandemic, there were reports that, you know, not many children were getting sick, and we thought that they were sort of generally safer or less at risk than adults or others with underlying conditions from having complications. Does this discovery change that analysis at all?
I don't think so. COVID virus, the acute infection, respiratory infection, is generally very mild or asymptomatic in kids. I think kids will get it and not get sick. But it does mean that we are maybe falsely reassured that there were no complications. The good news is this is a very serious illness, and kids are getting very sick, but that has responded to hospitalizations. It has been nearly uniformly survivable, but it is a very serious illness.
So as we look towards, loosening some of the stay-at-home restrictions, there's a lot of discussions about summer camps and if kids will be able to go back to school. How might this syndrome complicate or change those conversations?
I don't want to alarm people, but it is something that needs to be taken into consideration as we bring large groups of kids back together. How common is it? It's not common, but is it really rare or just a little rare? And I make those numbers up, but it's important as we look at, does this happen 1 out of 10,000 times? Does it happen 1 out of 100 times? It's less than 1 out of 100, but how often does it happen? So these will inform us in our public health policy as we move forward. And we're not quite sure what direction that's going to be.
That's Dr. Doug Carlson. He's chair of the Department of Pediatrics at the SIU School of Medicine in Springfield. You're listening to Statewide. You can check out our website, statewideshow.com, and stick around for more coming up right after this. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Still to come, we'll find out how a new city alderman in one town has been keeping busy during the coronavirus pandemic. Well, it was announced that Illinois bars and restaurants can host customers with outdoor seating arrangements, possibly within the next week. Governor J.B. Pritzker ordered the establishments to only allow curbside and delivery service as a way to slow the spread of COVID-19, and now the governor is offering a new option. He says outdoor seating with patrons kept at least 6 feet apart and having servers wear masks will be allowed as the state prepares to move into its new reopening phase. That could happen on May 29th. Sam Toya is president of the Illinois Restaurant Association. He says this will help a hard-hit industry.
Today's announcements provides a glimmer of light at the end of this very dark tunnel.
The earliest date that indoor dining would be allowed, though, is still more than a month away. A speech from the class valedictorian is a staple of high school graduation ceremonies. And since many won't have that chance this year, at least in person, Peter Medlin talked with a few valedictorians about their speeches and their reflections on the weirdest senior year ever.
A few weeks ago, Xavier Hutzel's mom called and woke him up at 10 in the morning. She was crying. That's usually not a good sign, but this time, it was. She was calling to congratulate him on being named valedictorian of his class at Roosevelt Community Education Center in Rockford.
I was just rubbing my eyes, and I was like, wait, what's going on? I'm like, are you sure? Like, me?
It was surprising because Xavier wasn't sure if he was even going to graduate on time, let alone at the very top of his class. The road to graduation was not easy for Xavier, and that's something he wanted to get across in his valedictorian speech.
The things that I've been through have definitely been, it's put a permanent humbleness in me.
And as Hutzel says, what you say and what you do, whether it be bullying or discrimination, has an effect, and not just in the moment.
I want people to know that what we do now does impact what happens in the future. And I don't think my generation realizes that yet.
Jada Cox is the valedictorian at Jefferson High School in Rockford. In her speech, Jada wants her fellow classmates to know that if they still don't know what they're going to do after graduation, don't worry about it.
We don't have to be hard on ourselves, and we don't have to have everything figured out right now. You know, the next few years are supposed to be about change and growth.
A recent survey showed 27% of students have changed their post-grad plans due to COVID-19, and many are concerned with how the pandemic will impact their ability to pay for school. Neither Jada nor Xavier felt like they needed to talk about the elephant in the virtual room too much in their speech. Jada says she acknowledged the virus, but tried not to dwell on it.
My opening line was, we stand here today, or more likely sit, in this very unconventional situation, on the precipice of the future. And that's like really the only time that I like strictly mention it.
Jada's the type of person who's been thinking about where she wants to go to college since before she was in high school. She's going to be attending College of William and Mary in Virginia. And moving across the country can be stressful, especially in the midst of a public health crisis. And she's less than thrilled at the prospect of taking online classes once she gets there.
I am scared. I did not work this hard for 4 years to be like, oh, online school. I don't like online school.
As for his future, Xavier's still looking at colleges. And the fall classes at many universities may still be online has changed his perspective as well.
It's very iffy for me, like having a dorm room there or something.
Xavier didn't have to do much e-learning, and he's thankful for that as he's more of a hands-on learner. Jada agrees, and as she said, she doesn't like online classes. Plus, Jada says the e-learning workload at Jefferson varied pretty dramatically between her different classes.
My AP Econ teacher and my AP English Lit teacher were like very much like homework almost every day, like Google Meets once a week to like come check in if you need help and like that kind of stuff.
Even with their academic honors, the valedictorians both say it's hard not to see their senior years as somewhat anticlimactic. They didn't get the chance to really say goodbye to their teachers and friends, and there really wasn't a last day of school, even though they didn't know it at the time. Jada says that last day was the last day before spring break, so it was nothing remarkable.
I don't even remember my last day of actual school.
Jada and Xavier may not get to walk across the stage at graduation, let alone shake hands with the principal as they take their diploma in a gym packed with people, and they probably won't get to give their speeches the way they'd envision, but they'll still get to give them, just with a little bit less pomp and circumstance. Both of their schools are holding digital graduation ceremonies, and they'll get to give their speech in front of a camera at home. At least now they'll have a few takes to get it right and get their message across as they sit, as Jada Cox says, on the precipice of the future. I'm Peter Medlin.
And now Adriana Cardona-Magiga brings us the story of a Chicago student who says she was in disbelief when she learned she was a valedictorian.
I'd like to thank everyone for being here to celebrate and recognize the success and achievements of every graduate of my class.
Eileen Limon is reading a draft of her graduation speech. She's this year's valedictorian at Our Lady of Tepeyac, an all-girls Catholic high school in Little Village on the southwest side.
I know our graduation isn't what we all expected it to be when we thought of the day we would leave high school and explore unfamiliar sites.
Eileen doesn't know if she'll be able to give her speech in front of her classmates and family. She has been working on it since her principal and school counselor gave her the news that she was a top student.
I was in a little disbelief for a little bit, and I was so happy, you know, after like, you know, all those late nights where I would have to like do my work, make sure it was right, and just making everything the best as I could. It just felt really great.
Getting to where she's now hasn't been easy. Eileen has autism and has had difficulties understanding what others are trying to say. She was diagnosed when she was 3.5 years old. Back then, she had the vocabulary of an 8-month-old. Her mother, an immigrant from Mexico who speaks mostly in Spanish, sought help right away. Eileen learned sign language at first and received speech therapy through elementary and middle school. Fourth and fifth grade were some of the hardest years for her.
It was sometimes hard to like understand my classmates and communicate with them. And some were nice, but others weren't very nice. And even though they didn't know what I had, they could tell that I was a little different from other kids. So it was kind of hard to like make friends.
She remembers being rejected in the playground when she was little, bullied, and singled out. She also remembers noticing when people had lower expectations for her.
Sometimes people would make remarks or tell me that I wasn't going to succeed and I wasn't going places and I wouldn't be able to do as many things as kids who are non-autistic would.
She wanted to prove them wrong and prove to herself and others with autism
they can do anything that they put their minds to.
Eileen joined a Mexican folkloric dance group when she was in middle school. It helped her deal with the stress of communicating with others.
Because, you know, we weren't having to use our voices at that time. We just had to, like, use our feet and dance.
At Our Lady of Tepeyac, work has been challenging at times, but school administrators say Eileen is a strong self-advocate who reaches out to teachers and counselors when she needs help. She also has developed strong friendships. For the fall, she has been accepted to Lawrence University in Wisconsin. She's happy, but she laments one thing.
You know, being valedictorian and not being able to, like, well, you know, give my speech on the day of graduating was upsetting.
At least not the conventional way. A recorded version of her speech will go on the school's website. The school is also planning a drive-through ceremony later this month. Eileen understands safety comes first. Meanwhile, she keeps working on her speech in case she gets to read it sometime this summer.
To my peers and friends who taught me the importance to have fun with others, to my principal, teachers, and faculty always teaching me to reach out for opportunities, and especially to my mother. The sacrifice and was always by my side throughout my life in helping me to grow and become the person she knew I could be.
Adriana Cardona Magigad, WBEC News.
This is Statewide. The Federal Bureau of Prisons will no longer use the Thompson facility in Illinois as a coronavirus quarantine location for newly admitted inmates. Chase Cavanaugh brings us that story.
Previously, Thompson and 10 other locations would have quarantined these inmates for a few weeks. But a bipartisan letter to the Bureau from U.S. lawmakers raised the specter of transferred asymptomatic individuals becoming a source for new outbreaks. Illinois U.S. Representative Sherry Bustos explains.
Well, the entire Bureau of Prisons did not have a well-thought-out plan on this. Again, they had 11 sites throughout the country, but none of these transferred inmates were they planning to test before they were transferred.
That list has now dropped to 3 sites, and prisoners being transferred to the remaining quarantine sites will be screened for COVID-19. Bustos says the lack of healthcare capacity in the Thompson area would have put the health of prison staff, inmates, and the community in jeopardy if COVID-19 emerged there. I'm Chase Cavanaugh.
The coronavirus pandemic has changed how elected officials serve their constituents. Olivia Mitchell brings us the story of Springfield's newest and youngest alderman and how his job is different now, but his focus remains the same.
I met up with Sean Gregory at Boy's Restaurant on Springfield's east side, where he is giving out free barbecue dinners.
We're trying to just give back and work with some of our local businesses to, you know, one, to help them, and two, to feed the community, as well as, you know, give out some information such as COVID information and census information as well.
In March, as the coronavirus hit Illinois, city council meetings moved online and many community events were canceled or postponed. Gregory says what's changed is the communication.
Not really being able to meet face-to-face with people, which is different for me because I'm more of a face-to-face person going to meet and getting out and going to see problems and different issues like that when my constituents call me.
Still, Gregory says it's particularly important for his neighbors to see him not only helping out, but also wearing a mask and taking the disease seriously.
On the eastern half of this city, from the south to the north, you have a bulk of the COVID cases, and we're seeing them spiking up. So we want to try to get out here, get masks, get information.
The part of Springfield considered to be the east side is when you cross the 11th Street Railroad tracks all the way south to Stevenson and all the way north to North Grand. Neighborhoods east of the tracks are predominantly Black, and many have boarded up houses and businesses. During his campaign, Gregory promised to bring a fresh perspective to the city council, but he had a rocky start to his term. On election day last spring, his opponent Gail Simpson won by 1 vote, and she served for a couple months during a contentious recount. The final result came down to drawing a ping pong ball out of a bag. Simpson, who served on the city council before and ran for mayor, had a lot of support.
I had elected Gail. When it got down to the election itself, it came down to a matter of experience.
That's Jeanette Goza, who's on the elected board that oversees the Bank of Springfield Center in downtown. As a resident of Ward 2, she says she didn't know Gregory that well.
I didn't feel like he probably had made enough connections to really represent the ward well.
But as time went on, Gregory's hard work and dedication won her over.
I think that he's really doing some things that are positive.
Community activist Erica Alston, also a Ward 2 resident, says Gregory is different from other politicians she has voted for in the past.
Somebody my age, so passionate about the community, wanted to make the change, not just talking, but actually walking the walk.
Alston likes the way Gregory is handling his job as alderman, but she says homelessness, violence, lack of businesses on the east and north side of town, and other problems that have plagued the area for years need to be solved.
The restaurants should not be leaving our side of town to go to the west side. I feel like the east side needs just as much of a presence of businesses as the west side.
Addressing racial and economic divides in Springfield has been the agenda for many aldermen over the years. And even during the pandemic, it's a focus for Gregory. The city of Springfield has nearly $800,000 in federal money from the CARES Act for coronavirus relief efforts. Gregory says his main priority is ensuring that residents and businesses in his ward will receive their fair share because the area is usually overlooked.
And one of the things that I come to do is really give city government and all government that I can get my voice reached to is a real true outlook of what a community like mine goes through.
The alderman says the pandemic has slowed down his planning on some economic development projects and two training academies where people learn to be carpenters or barbers.
And I'm sort of getting back to that now as part of the recovery stage.
He says people not being allowed to work and people dying from the virus causes strain on the struggling community.
It has put more priority on the things that my community needs because I think it set us back even further than what the community was.
I'm Olivia Mitchell.
That's all the time we have for Statewide. We'll be back next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Our website is statewideshow.com. It's where you can find links to the stories you hear each week. Our podcast is also available through the NPR One app. Statewide is brought to you by AARP Illinois, providing information that can help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.